6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
I'm not glamorous. I'm not this created pop star. Fortunately, I don't have this image that I have to live up to. There's always an element of either melancholy, I think must be awful, that has to be put right through creativity. Art, it can save me. Often it's from these darkest, bleakest periods. It's magical, really. I don't know whether it can save humanity.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Well, it's lovely to see you, Anne Clark. It really is.
And you, Steve. English.
And I'm going to start with something, and I'm sorry to say this, but I'm going to start with something that sounds a little facile, but it isn't. And I really want to ask you what you have done so far today, because we're at 12 o'clock, just 2 minutes past 12, and I just wondered what you've done today.
Today I have written in my journal and I have walked my pet dogs.
All right, okay. The reason I ask that is because you've been through a very difficult period because of having cancer. And I presume by having cancer, you reassess your whole life and you look at your life and you think differently about it. Can you tell me how you now think differently and what does every day mean to you?
Wow, yes. I mean, it's been a huge 18 months. I mean, not just for me. I think for everybody, the whole world, you know, obviously because of the COVID situation. I mean, everybody's lives were thrown into some kind of disruption, I think. But yeah, I got my diagnosis at exactly the same time as the UK, where I was at the time, went into lockdown. So it was a bit, yeah, it was very frightening and very terrifying. And of course, it's a diagnosis that none of us want, but about 50% of us, if not more, are going to get, you know, at some point in our lives. So of course, it was completely devastating and exacerbated by the COVID situation. But I had such a fantastic doctor and network of doctors and it was just incredible. I mean, that lesson, the first time in hospital, that really made me reassess everything. When you had the wards, you know, with maybe up to 30, 40 patients all around these different units, and suddenly all the nurses except one being sent off to quarantine just in case because they'd been in contact with someone with COVID, and this tireless way that they worked and how they really worked, it just made me, like I think many people, you know, just realize who the real heroes and the real important people are.
But many people who go through something like cancer and come out the other side, it's the reassessment that they have is the value of life, to realizing Absolutely. That you only have one life.
Yep.
And you have to make something with it. So I just wondered, were there specific changes that you have adopted because of that, or after this amount of time, I presume you have an all clear now in a certain sense. Well, I don't know if there can be.
There's never an all clear, you know? No. I mean, there's never an all clear. The doctors have told me, you know, it could come back tomorrow. And at the moment, I've got the all clear. So, yes, it's taught me very much to live. I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it's taught me to live every moment at the time, you know, and not take any moment for granted or any day for granted, because I just don't know. Again, like none of us know, but when you've had that diagnosis, it's put really in front of your face. I just don't know if something will happen again. So I mean, I've always tried to grab every moment and live every moment as fully as possible, but even more now. So I think I must get on some people more with my over enthusiasm, you know, for the tiniest things and the smallest things, because as the saying goes, you know, take care of the small things, because one day they'll be the biggest things in your life, you know. And yeah, I've tried to be more patient, which I find difficult, and I've tried to be kinder, which with the current political and world situation isn't always easy. But yeah, you know, whether you've got cancer or not, you're just a human, and you have your reactions, and but yeah, I try to take a breath and then respond, you know, to things. So yeah.
I'm a writer today, I'm a screenwriter. And one of the things about when you write, obviously, as you know, is searching for your voice. And searching for your voice, you're always looking at events in your past that formed you and had an impact on you. And one of my earliest memories is, and when I read about your childhood, but one of my earliest memories is one of extreme anger between my mother and father when humankind, shouldn't say that, God, when humankind landed on the moon. This moment, the 20th of July, was my mother's birthday. And all I remember it for is they had this massive fight. And my father was a market trader, and he used to throw money around the room. And it was a bit like East Germany. There would be pock marks all over the walls. like the aftermath of the war, still sort of scars everywhere. And he wasn't very often, but he could be a very violent person. And a lot of my memories are formed from the relationship I had with my father. And because you experienced a lot of anger in your childhood, I wondered, first of all, how did that take place? What were those events? And how did that make you feel?
Cool. Well, I mean, it went back as far back as I can remember to a tiny child, you know, to being a tiny child. So of course you think it's normal. It wasn't till I was older and went to school and saw how other families behaved with each other, but actually it wasn't normal at all. So that was quite shocking. And the thing is that anger really wasn't processed through my parents with each other. They passed it through their children and would aim it at my brother and I. So it was very violent and very aggressive and very changing. I mean, my mum was so volatile, you know. She would be the most funny, brilliant, charming, charismatic woman one second, and then this monster the next second that would just throw me down the stairs, fight with my brother till the neighbours called the police, and it was just horrendous. I mean, and completely destabilizing. But maybe like you, that's how I ended up writing and found such refuge in music and books and film and anything, you know. Fortunately, I had my little bedroom, and that was my haven whenever it could be. And yeah, there I discovered the whole world of music, books, writing. Yeah, another world altogether, which was wonderful, but it was quite a hard way to discover it.
Did you feel very isolated at that time? Because that's the feeling. I mean, I used to sit in my room as well, and my outlet was more music than anything else that I would really dive into. I mean, you know, things like Bowie and so on and so forth. But I mean, it was that was really my outlet in that area. But how did that make you feel? Did it make you feel isolated as a
well, yeah, person? I bet. I mean, it's quite funny in a way now looking back on it, because going to school, you know, being 11, 12, 13, going through puberty, I think, and of course, along with all the other girls at school, I loved David Cassidy and I loved, you know, all the boy, but I, my real heartthrob was Brian Eno and all these weird people, David Bowie, who of course came to be much more acceptable, but all these kind of like weird musicians, and you know, all the kids at school would be listening to, I don't know, what would it have been then, the Osmonds and the Carpenters, and I would come along with you know, Brian Eno's Here Come the Warm Jets album, or Greenslade, or just totally obscure things. So of course, yeah, that always made me feel a bit isolated, and yeah, the situation did.
I mean, one thing you just mentioned there was that you didn't realize what a normal relationship was, because your parents didn't have a normal relationship. I remember seeing the parents of friends of mine sitting on a sofa holding hands and asking this guy, why are they doing that?
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, yeah, you can analyze it till the cows come home, really. I mean, for me, yes, it was just this amazement of tenderness, that tenderness could actually exist between people. It was like, wow, you know, and you could see people like, well, you know, what's the problem? It was just like, wow, people can be tender. And I mean, I'm painting this picture, but there were times, you know, my father was destroyed by it. And I'm sure my mother was destroyed by whatever caused this violence within them, this emotional violence, you know. But I just can't say, oh, it's all their fault, and you know, they were terrible parents. Because to be honest, although we might have had friends who have got nice parents, there's an awful lot of screwed up parents out there. And I also came to realize that, yeah, actually my parents may have been very extreme, but there are many dysfunctional families out there.
I think so. Also, we only know things like this because of people like you who are honest, or people, you know, like myself, who are willing to talk about those points. And I remember that my father was a very absent father, even though he was there emotionally. And that definitely had a massive impact on my life, in the sense of, I think I looked for love in other areas in my life because of his absence emotionally. And I know that from my mother, she told me this amazing story once where he didn't want a third child and I was the third son. And he never had anything to do with me when I was young. And that, of course, had a massive impact. And I just wondered also, because an absent parent does cause you to search for things outside yourself to replace that, what you don't get from your parent. So
yeah,
I wondered,
sure,
whether
you know,
your whole life
it
has been based on this search for love. Yes. That could be from an audience, you know.
Yes, I mean, I think many performers are desperately seek attention seekers, obviously. I mean, anyone who stands up in front of hundreds or thousands of people saying, look at me, listen to me, they're obviously searching for something. But again, at the time, yeah, my father was the same. He would leave the house at 7 in the morning and wouldn't come home till 10 o'clock at night. And then at the weekends, he'd be in his shed or his garage the whole time. And it was just normal. It was just, oh yeah, dad's not there, you know, that's what he does. And of course, all the time it's having this influence in you, but I don't think I became aware of it until I was older, you know. And yes, then yeah, there's this constant searching, this looking for normality in a way, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I just
people think, oh, when you're a musician or everything's like about excess and outrage and extreme, but this search for just normality, a normal evening meal together at the table for me is paradise, you know, with people just chatting and drinking a glass of wine, or it's just like, wow, you know. And
yeah, I mean, the other thing is I ended up being on MTV, and I think my search for love was to be on TV to get people to love me who I didn't know. But you don't get love, that isn't love. So being on a stage isn't real love. It's the adoration of an audience or their, you know, their love of your music or whatever, but it's not actual real love. So did you also go through that point where you realized that what you were searching for actually wasn't the real thing, and then you had to change away from that again?
Not really, so, because one very important thing for me is that in my career and me as a person, for me, I'm very certain about it's the material. It's my material that people get something from for whatever reason. I don't know why. I don't know why they like it. I mean, nobody was more shocked than me to be invited to go to Germany and America and wherever to do my stuff. Because, yeah, I was just this wakey, punky teenager and doing my stuff. And so for me, it's always been about the material. And if I'm not interested really what people think of me or what they want to know, because I'm not the important element. You know, I'm not glamorous. I'm not this created pop star. I don't have this, fortunately, I don't have this image that I have to live up to, you know, which is, I think, must be awful for real. As we live in now, celebrity icons, you know, that must be awful. But then in a way, I guess they like the superficiality of that also, perhaps. I can't say. So always it's the material and not them loving me. Yeah, I think there was an element of actually being wanted, of being felt that I could contribute something to other people.
I mean, there's a universality in the themes that you write about. So that's part of the connection. The other connection is, of course, you build this world with the music that we dive into. And so it's almost like we experience that alone, but together. Do you know what I mean? I think that's my experience of your music. There's some sort of universality, but there's also some element of me being on my own within your world that is also my world.
Yeah, I mean, that's the wonderful, beautiful thing about, for want of a better word, art, isn't it? You know, whether it's a book or a painting or a film or a piece of music. And that's the other thing, that once I've done it, once I've written it, or it's not my, I give it out there and people can interpret it however they want. You know, when people say, oh, well, what is this text about? Or what is that? It doesn't really matter what it's about to me. It matters what it's about to them, you know.
Now, there you are as a very young person in your room listening to Brian Eno. But at that time, you were also going to school. And although I live in Germany, I was brought up in Britain, and I went through the British school system. And my school system was an arts and sciences-based school, all about passing, you know, your O-levels, your A-levels, your 11 plus, whatever. And it was never about creativity in any form at all. And I always had a sort of hatred of the school system in Britain. And I read in an interview that you also have that sort of, I don't know, hatred's such a big word, but you also have that sort of feeling about the school system in Britain. What was your experience at school and why did you feel that way?
Well, it's interesting, really. Again, it was quite bizarre, my schooling, because I went to the regular primary school up to and junior school, and then at 11 we were all shipped off to the secondary schools, and for some reason I ended up in this, it was at the time when grammar schools, comprehensive schools had merged with grammar schools, and comprehensive had merged, so I ended up in this very quite high level school in Old Causton in Surrey. So there was this immediate class thing to begin with, because most of the other kids there were either doctors' kids or lawyers' kids, or, and my dad was a paramedic, you know, so it wasn't quite the same league as that. And also there was this real discrepancy between my ability with, for example, mathematics and sciences and art and literature. So I was like in the highest class for English and literature, the lowest class for mathematics and science, because it was just something that, yeah, I didn't get. And it caused me a lot of confusion, and my teachers a lot of confusion, I think. And yeah, maybe it's just, you know, I need a very late autism diagnosis or something. I'm not sure. But there were only very certain things that I could really focus on and really be interested in, to be honest, you know, physics and science, and they didn't really, mathematics, I just wasn't interested in them, you know.
You said, you know, about retreating to your room and listening to Brian Eno, that what, on a positive sense, what did your parents open you up to creatively, or was there any creativity in the household?
Well, that's what's so bizarre, is that, you know, at these very small periods, my mom would introduce me to classical music. She'd have Mozart and Chopin playing, and she would take me with a friend of hers to Royal Festival Hall to hear a piano recital of Chopin or something. And it was like, whoa, where did that come from, you know? So she did, yeah, something inside her really could appreciate and love this very, what's the word, sensitive and creative essence in the world. But yeah, the rest of the time it was just something else. But yeah, my father, I didn't see enough to, I mean, he was a very smart guy. I mean, he'd been born out in India, in the Himalayas out there, and he could speak every dialect of Indian, you know, like when, if we go to a Indian restaurant or something, this tall blonde guy would start speaking Urdu or Punjabi or to the all the waiters, and there'd be a big party in the restaurant because of that. And I know that I think during the wartime he was very much an active, you know, soldier in the war, and yeah, he traveled the whole world during from India to eventually the UK. But he never lived to his potential, and that made me very sad to see him get old and be, as I say, completely destroyed by this very strong, very powerful, but very negative woman, ultimately, which was my mom, you know.
When were you first exposed to poetry?
Oh, I don't know. Again, at school, of course, we'd have to read poetry, but the first poem that really made me sit up and read it thoroughly was a Charles Causley poem when I was about, how old would I have been? I don't know, 12, 13 maybe? Song of a Dying Gunner, it's called. And yeah, it just starts with this line, "Oh mother, my mouth is full of stars as cartridges in their tray," you know? And it was just like, what is that? What kind of language is that? You know, it was just like all these images and visualizations that came from the language. So yeah, I guess 10, 11, 12, something like that.
And that was a trigger for you to read more poetry.
Yeah.
And so where did you, I mean, when you're at school and you're, I don't know, possibly then the only person who has that. I mean, I remember in English classes that poetry was sort of a throwaway. It was like something you won't, here's something you won't be interested in. And yeah, they'd already told us we wouldn't be interested in it. So we weren't interested in it at the start, which was a real shame because it took years before I could come back and appreciate, you know, a great part of our culture. Yeah.
That's it, the way it was taught or is taught even now, perhaps. I mean, who the hell wants to sit and listen to, you know, Longfellow being read by, you know, 60-year-old teacher who's reading it like he's reading the telephone directory or something, you know? It's just, yeah, but I think probably now it's much more interesting for kids, especially with all the rap and hip hop influences and stuff that's been going on for years now. I think, yeah, maybe kids, I don't know. It's up to every individual to see what they want to see and hear what they want to hear.
The outsider has always played a great role in popular culture. You know, I mean, because I was a Bowie fan, you got to listen to a Bowie album or the names of it, you know, the Alien, the Outsider. Yeah. It's all about being somewhere else and somewhere out there. Do you feel that has played a big role in your journey as an artist?
Well, I think you recognize it. I think fellow outsiders, whatever, recognize each other, whether that's possibly meeting in a bar or reading a book or listening to a piece of music. You know, I think, yeah, it has to have an influence. I don't think it's something I try not to dwell on too much, because it can make you feel very lonely and very isolated in a way. It's not something to dwell on if at all possible. And of course, there are so many, many very isolated and lonely people out there who don't have any means of expression or ways of connecting, you know.
Was that the experience that you had when you worked at the Cainhill Psychiatric Hospital? Was that where that moment came, where you saw these people who were really on the edge of society, I presume? And also, you know, the track Cainhill really expresses and puts you in that world. And it is quite tough and quite moving and painful, I think. And so I just wondered, you experienced it when you were working there, and you went back because of your documentary. And I just wondered if you can talk about those two experiences and how it had changed over the years in terms of your view of it.
Yeah. I mean, if there's one glorious part of my education and one thing I really cherish, it was the fact that at this secondary school out in Old Causden, which is where what they were called then lunatic asylums were, Cainhill was on the suburbs of London, this old Victorian building. And part of our social studies class was every few weeks was to go there as a class and assist in the hospital. I mean, I can't imagine that they would even consider it now, even allow it now, you know. I don't know, with all the regulations and things, but we would go there, maybe 10 or 11 of us, and we would just sit with some of these people and talk with them. And the initiative, whoever the teacher was or the part of the school was that initiated that, they deserve, I don't know what, because for me, that was the biggest education of my life, to just go there and see these people, see a man who was then in his late 70s, who'd been there as a young boy because he stole a loaf of bread because his family was so poor. Or another woman completely institutionalized in her 80s because she got pregnant when she was 15 or 16 or something, and just put there. To see this fragility and this vulnerability of people, and to have this ability to communicate with people, which I didn't have at home, and to just listen and talk to them, and them just being so happy just to be able to talk with someone and sit with someone and read a book with someone or have a bite to eat with them, you know, if you felt. But yeah, of course, then the other extreme was in the hospital. They had very, very dangerous people in there, very psychotic, and people that, yeah, you know, it wasn't too, which we shouldn't have even been around as kids, really, but sometimes we did see that. And for me, it opened up a whole new world of understanding people or wanting to know about people. You know? Now, of course, Cainhill is luxury apartment blocks. I mean, at the time it used to be, it was wonderful. I mean, they had a farm, they had their own farm where they would work, and yeah, it was the most beautiful place. But of course, along with the beauty, when I did go and work there for a while after school, there was incredible cruelty too from some of the staff. I mean, really wicked behavior. So that opened up another view of it. And yeah, a lot, then in the 80s, the Care in the Community initiative came, whatever that means. I don't know what that means. And they were all closed down. I don't know what happened to all the patients. But when I went there with Klaus to make the video, they cut down every tree, ripped up every beautiful thing, and they were now selling luxury apartments there. I think the energy and the ghosts there must be quite interesting for people that are living there now.
When I talked to John Watts the other week from Fisher's Ed, he worked as a clinical psychologist, and although he made a joke about it, he meant it in some truth, that he said he used to be with psychopaths in the day and be on stage with psychopaths in the evening. And I'm not going to ask you if you're a psychopath, but what I'm saying is that fragility that you mentioned and this feeling that you got from those people, I empathize with that as a writer, definitely, that pain and that sensitivity. So I just wondered that, is that what you empathize with more than anything else, that you felt part of yourself or saw part of yourself in them as a reflection?
It must be. I think it must be, Stephen. I really think so. I think it has to be that this fascination, you know, with these people's stories. When we were kids at the school, coming out of the school, there'd be these horror stories, you know, and when the winter evenings and autumn evenings drew in and we'd have to walk past the hospital to get the bus home, you know, we'd all have this, you know, there's going to be a Mad Axe guy waiting there at the bus stop. So you had this crazy imagination, this Edgar Allan Poe scenario going on. So it stimulated all kinds of things, but ultimately the humanity of the stories of the people there. And that's, for me, is the huge thing lacking, and the huge things we're distracted by with politics and consumerism, when if only our sensitivity towards each other could be nurtured, what a different world we would have, you know?
Mentioned a bit earlier about finding your own people, finding people with similar interests, finding people who think similarly. You were brought up in Croydon, I think. Yeah. I was brought up in Chelmsford, which is the other side of London. Also, both horrendous
little cities.
And it took me years to find people who I could relate to at all. Where did you find your first clique?
Was it
at the theatre, do you think?
No, I think it was really with punk rock. I really think when that kicked up, because I mean, however abysmal Croydon and the surroundings are, it was really a cradle of creativity during the punk rock thing, you know? And I mean, this awful industrial wasteland there, but yeah, it produced, and the energy that came up from that was incredible. So it was really in the punk rock movement, I think. But I think more as it developed into a new wave thing with a little bit more creativity and a bit more thinking behind it, you know, there was this very powerful, destructive element that just pushed everything away, which of course, when you're 16 years old or something, you just fall in love with. But then as it all settled, as it all settled back down, these very creative elements came from it. And I found really what you call a clique, although I don't know if that's the right word, but that group of people there that I could really relate to.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
I mean, you mentioned just a moment ago about societal problems today, based on money, I would say, is what you're talking about as well. But in the 70s and 80s, for me, there was rampant homophobia, sexism, racism, misogyny. I mean, you name it, it was shit. You know, yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah, awful. Absolutely. And if you weren't part of that group that were in this, you were really an outsider. And you really felt different. But, and then I think you've got to the core of it, that punk, a new wave came along, and it provided a hook to be involved in if you weren't part of this other bigger group around you. Yeah. That's the feeling that I had. Do you think that's part of it? And actually part of creativity is sometimes in the worst of situations, the best of creativity exists.
I think that is repeated over and over again, and not just on a societal level or political level, but in people's own emotional level too. I mean, it's a real cliche, but the tormented artist, you know, I mean, really, who has produced the most incredible artworks? I think very often the most damaged and disturbed people. It's not always true, but I mean, there's always an element of either melancholy or something there that's not quite right, that has to be put right through creativity, or attempted to be put right through creativity, I think.
I mean, during that era, I mean, as a gay man who came out in 1977, you know, when being, I'm going to call it gay, because at that point it was called gay, LGBTQ plus or whatever, and being in that part of society, you weren't even a human being, really. I mean, it was terrible in the 70s. In the 80s, it got a little better, but you were I was abused in the street. I was beaten up by police at one point. And to have that happen to you, I wonder if my experience was the experience of every woman in that era.
Cool. How do you mean exactly, Steve? Because, I mean, well, you're talking about very direct violence there. And
no, yeah, okay, that's slightly different. But I think in terms of, well, misogyny was so big. I mean, it was so rampant. I mean, if you look at the police forces in the 70s, you know, it's really well documented now about how misogynistic they were. Society is misogynistic, you know. It is. Never talk about, never mind then, it is today also misogynistic. But back then, the level of misogyny was so massive, so high. And I know that, you know, like a song, Wallies, really, you know, gives a sort of hint to that. But I just wondered what it was like, not only being an outsider in that period and being part of the punk movement and later on the new wave movement, but being part of those movements, but also being a woman, and whether you look back and go, Christ, did I really put up with that?
Well, yes. Yeah, but again, at the time, again, you just think this is normal, like going into the recording studio, you know, with the engineers and them looking at you with such contempt that you would even want to consider sitting by the mixing desk. You know, go and put the kettle on, you know, and it's just like, oh, yeah, right. You know, it's just like, oh, yeah, that's, and it's not till obviously time and things evolve that you think, my God. But at the time, it's just, oh, yeah. You know, I'm the only girl here. I have to go make the tea, or I have to, you know, and it's just like, wow, you know. So, yes, yeah. But
I mean, it takes power to go through those situations and come out of them in the right way.
Yeah, well, that's
because it's so easy to say, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah, but yeah, even when, you know, I'd go and make the tea, but then I'd come back and make damn sure that I got what I wanted from the recording session, however much of a double fight it was, you know, to do it. It's not until you actually sit back and think about it that you realise, my God, you know, yeah.
Was in the recording studio, was that a fight from the start until you found, in a sense, found your feet and found your power?
Yes, but again, it wasn't conscious, you know. It was just like, this is the process. I've got these 10 songs or whatever. I want to record them. I want to make an album. I've got to fight with my fellow musician. I've got to fight with the engineer. I've got to fight with the record company. But that's just part of the process. You know, I've got to fight when I go home and see my parents. I've got to fight when I see my brother. So there wasn't anything exceptional or unusual. And it's only from getting other perspectives and distance that you really, really see it.
I mean, I listened to The Sitting Room this morning and I love the images it painted. And for me, it didn't feel of a different era. It just felt like a wonderful piece of art. And I just wondered when I listened to it, because I sort of, you know, as I said before, you do have the feeling that you're going into a different world when you're listening to what you make, you know, your poetry and music together. And for me, I just wondered at the end of it, when I was listening to it, I wondered if that alleviated, by actually creating that, you had the feeling that it alleviated some of the problems that you had gone through in your life. Because as a writer, when I write, there is something very powerful about, instead of holding on to the pain, but bringing that pain, it's not always pain, but bringing that pain into your work is an incredible thing, because in some way it gives you an understanding, a distance, it alleviates it slightly, and you move on from it. And I wondered, because you were so young at that stage, whether that's something that you really experienced or whether it's something that you later looked back on and said that worked.
If so much is in retrospect, you know, really, that it was so cathartic. But at the time, yeah, I wouldn't have acknowledged that. You know, I wouldn't have said that. It was for me about personally being able to gather up ideas and formulate them, put them together, and release them. Yeah, there was always it was always done on a shoestring, you know, and always done very quickly. And like I say, with these, the engineers, like, what's this weird shit, you know, and all this stuff. So there was always quite a lot of pressure, but I just accepted it as normal. But yes, there was definitely a healing process with that, and in the formulating of it, not just the actual recording and releasing, but the gathering sounds and writing and collaborating with the musicians. You know, it was the whole process. I mean, do you work with music as well?
No, just words. So just writing. Okay. But the thing is, when you write a screenplay, I mean, yeah, I haven't had any success, but I'm on the verge, I hope, but I'm getting there. And it's not about having the success, it's about doing it. It really is. Although I want the success as well, financially. Yeah. You are painting pictures when you're writing a screenplay, yes, you know, and so that's how I can associate with what you're doing with poetry and music together, because it is creating a whole world. And with a screenplay, you're also creating a world. You have, yes, to create the world in which your screenplay takes place. So I think there is a sort of similarity with that. So I sort of get that totally.
Yeah.
What's going to ask? Yeah, David Harrow was someone that you worked with then, after The Sitting Room. And what attracted you to him as an artist? Because it seems an odd thing to sort of, what I read is you bumped into him and it was like, yeah, let's do something together, but not really.
Yeah. I mean, that was, again, the very punky new wave thing. Oh, let's just do something, you know? But the thing is, he was a very confident, very, how can I put this politely? Self-assured young man, and he just came up to me and he said, get rid of these wankers, you know, I can do much better than that. And it was like, whoa, okay. And
the word is cocky.
We had a very difficult relationship, and have an even more difficult relationship now, but it was very difficult and very conflicting, which maybe I was attracted to for some weird reason, I don't know, but it was also very creative. And again, that's this weird thing of creativity. I mean, we could barely stand being in the room together, but when we were, something would happen for these few numbers, these very successful numbers, which I'm eternally grateful for, and completely out of our control. It was just something that happened. And then we had absolutely nothing in common at all, you know, absolutely no way of I had no way of communicating with him, for sure.
I mean, you created Sleeper of Metropolis, you created Our Darkness.
Yeah.
You created those pieces which in a sense, epitomized that era and became, you know, some of the sort of stalwarts of that era.
Yes. Yeah.
But you didn't make money, did you?
No, not the money we should have. Absolutely not. And again, that was naivety and, yeah, that was the, or is still the nature of the music industry. You know, they just make it very clear to you that they're going to rip you off. And if you don't like it, or if you're not smart enough, or you don't have a great legal backing behind you, they're going to rip you off. And they did. They ripped us both off. And I really fought to get some of the money that we owed. I don't know how it went with David. I asked him to cooperate with me on it, because obviously the pair of us doing it together would have been a lot better. But he wasn't willing to, for whatever reason. He moved to the States and had his life out there. But no, we were owed hundreds of thousands of pounds, I think, to be honest, but we never saw it. No.
One of the really bad sides of the music industry, and I talked to someone about this the other day, it was Sam Brown, who is really a jazz singer. And because she had a pop hit, they wanted her to immediately have, called Stop, they wanted to have her immediately have another pop hit called Go or whatever, just do the same thing, basically. And that's when she suddenly grew up and realized, this isn't really what I want in my life and not what I want to have. How difficult, though, was that for you? Because you'd really, by that stage, you had three albums, I think. You'd also had enormous success. And in a way, you should have been able to determine your own career. But I presume they were saying to you, right, we want another darkness. We want, you know.
Yeah. Well, it went into huge conflict, you know, enormous conflict. I mean, I remember going to the Virgin offices at one point, just to ask for a small advance to do a remix with David for, I think it was Our Darkness or Sleeper in Metropolis. And we needed something like, I don't know, £2,000-£4,000, because the studios were so expensive then. And it was like, you know, and then as I'm sitting there, you know, I got to know a couple of the girls and guys working there. This young woman walks in and pushes in front of everyone and goes to see someone. And they say, oh, yeah, that's so-and-so's woman. She's just had a £350,000 advance to make an album, you know, this babe who nobody ever heard of again, but was just the right person for them at the right moment, was given this money, which never saw, as far as I know, the light of day. And, yeah, we had to fight and kick and scream to get £2,000-£3,000 to do a remix of a track that had already been a hit around the world, you know. So and just this sense of injustice. I couldn't accept this sense of injustice that, yeah, they take their cut, but we want our cut. It's just fair, you know. And so many musicians that I know and have known just don't want to get into the conflict of it, you know, that just don't want to enter into the whole legal thing. One, because it can break you financially, which it did nearly with me, do that. And secondly, it's just not in their nature, I think, to enter into these hugely conflictual situations. But maybe, again, from my great Irish genes of my mum or whatever, I just thought, there's no way I'm going to accept this, you know. And I took it really to the High Court and everything about it. But yeah, in the end, they still, as we see now, they've still got so much power and control, you know. They absorb every cultural movement that comes along and make it theirs, you know. So
I mean, I think we've seen it over the years many times, but it's not only breaking people financially, it's breaking them creatively.
Yeah
Because that stress going through that process, I mean, you know, that takes you away from what you're here and meant to do and your creativity. So that, I think, is one of the hardest
things. Well, that's it. The two are in complete conflict, but it seems they have to work together. You know, the creative side is completely the complete opposite of the money-making machine that is the music industry. And unfortunately, they always seem to come have to come back together in some way. Yeah.
So how did you come back to yourself? Because I know then, I think his name was Charlie Morgan, was a boyfriend of a friend of yours, I think.
Yeah.
And that's how you met him. And he was also a musician, but you had never wanted, or never thought, sorry, that's the wrong word. You'd never thought about working together. And then you went off to Norway. How did you bring your creativity back to yourself after that experience?
Yeah, it was very, very, very hard. I mean, I was completely broken by it, emotionally and financially and in every way possible. I was completely destroyed by it. And I had the good fortune to be able to go and live in Norway for a period of time, which is somewhere so different from anywhere I'd ever been or known. And it just came back again to the fundamentals, the basics of life. I mean, however comfortable and wealthy the people are out there in Norway, you know, which they are, they live very much in the with the nature, with the seasons, with light, with dark, with heat, with cold. And it was just this, what really matters, and what really mattered was sitting around a table or in the kitchen with friends, making food together, cooking together, eating together, lighting candles at 3 o'clock in the afternoon because it's so dark, and just talking and meeting musicians whose musicianship was beyond anything I'd ever witnessed before, who would just sit around in the lounge and play. And it was just like, that's what it's about. You know, that's what it's about, that creativity, that connection. And so we started working together, and slowly, I found my way back to putting material together. But of course, it's gone through a few cycles of this, circles of this experience, which I never seem to learn from, because I believe people when they say, we're going to help with your career and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. I think, oh yeah, they must mean that. But of course they don't. They mean they're going to make money for themselves.
So how, mentioned that that's happened a number of times, because you have taken periods off, long periods off, where you've obviously had to sort of find yourself and find your, or let's say sort of tank up again, you know, with creativity, be able to make something for yourself. So how do you get to a point where it goes? I mean, that for me is obviously as a writer, you have writer's block, you know, and you have periods where nothing comes and you can't force it. You know, you try and force it and it doesn't work, but there are other periods where it's just like, oh my God, I'm on a roll and it's just, this is fantastic. And I'm loving it, every minute of it. But years is for me at the moment seems to be an awful long time to step out and be able to sort of re-engage, if it's with nature like in Norway, or re-engage with other creativity to maybe help your own creativity. So how does it empty out of you?
I don't know, Stephen. I can't answer that. I mean, and I think it comes back to your questions at the beginning of the interview about how I feel and how I've changed and things. I mean, I live with this incredible, unbearable intensity a lot of the time, just this over sensitivity to everything. The golden leaves on the tree now, you know, they just fill my heart till it wants to burst. Or when I was in the hospital and I was really, really sick, and in the morning they opened the window of the hospital and the blackbird was singing outside the window every morning, and it just lifted me to, I can't explain, you know, and that goes the other way. When things bad happen, I just go boom down into this complete desolation, and have to pull myself back out of it again. And really,
when you pull yourself out, is it almost taking the desolation but putting it then into your work? Do you know what I mean? Because not all your work has this darkness. but a lot of it has this sort of atmospheric, I don't know what the real word I'm searching for is.
No, I know.
It does have
that
sort of element in it. And that's why I really love it, though. So I sort of appreciate maybe that when you have those dark times, it's almost the time, maybe that is the time where something's just about to come.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's what we were saying a little while ago, that often it's from these darkest, bleakest periods in people's lives and in society that the most creative things happen. It's magical, really. It's really something inexplicable. You can't define why and how it happens, I think.
There's a certain honesty that you need to have to be able to do what you do. And you've referenced it before with how do you be honest to yourself, Rilke, and so on. You know, like you've been there with your words and other people's words. But this honesty can be dangerous, because if everyone has access to everything about you, how do you protect yourself? Are you honest about everything about you, or do you keep things to yourself that protect yourself?
Yes, probably. I think we all do. I think everybody does. But saying that, Stephen, it's interesting that now with the age of social media that we're in, is that, and especially when, for example, when you talk to young people about the word privacy, you know, you just see this blank on their face. You say, like, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't give that information. Well, why not? And then I stop and I think, yeah, why not? That's true. That's how it is now, you know, that with social media and things, whether it's true or not, you know, I mean, it seems everybody's living the perfect life on Facebook and Instagram and everything. I'm not quite sure they are, but so many of us have just lost our inhibitions, and whether that's negative or positive, just come out with whatever, you know, whatever they want, whatever they're feeling, whatever they want to say. Whether it's being honest or not, I don't know. I don't know if it is. I'm sure there's many things I keep not secret, but don't talk about or have the need to talk about. But I don't understand how people can live together. I don't know how society works unless you're honest with each other in a way. If that makes sense.
I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning, I live in Germany. I've now got my dual nationality because of Brexit.
Yes.
And I've been here 27 years. I've always considered myself a European in any case.
Yes.
And one thing I love living in Germany, and I think it refers to most countries in Europe, if except Britain, and that is that there is no distinction between art. Art is art. So popular music is still seen as an art form.
Yes.
And in Britain, it's seen as something a little bit lower. So what interests me is that because you use words and you are best known today with people who are hearing those words in a second language.
Yes.
And I wondered why that is. And maybe it's because they're having to concentrate more and actually take interest in them. Do you see what I mean? It's that if you hear a piece of music or you hear a poem that you don't understand instantly, you've got to go and look at it and you've got to go and study it. Is there part of that in it? And how do you feel about how art is treated in Britain to how it is in Europe?
I don't understand how anything's treated in Britain. Don't ask me anything about it. I too got my Irish passport now that I travel with as, you know, a passionate European, and I am completely bewildered about not so much the British mentality, but the English mentality. You know, I think in Wales and, in Scotland and maybe, I don't know, I think it's a bit different mentality. So I can't answer anything about the English. I'm just furious about what they've done to a country that I love. And I don't mean that in a nationalistic or patriotic way, but I mean in the terroir, the earth, the nature of Britain is so beautiful. And I love it so much and I'm attached to it. But emotionally and politically and socially, I'm completely estranged from it. So it's, I have to get a drink, Stephen. Sorry.
Okay.
Can you just excuse me 1 second while I grab a glass of water? Or a bottle of water, as it is here. Yeah.
I've only got one final question in any case, because I mean, I know that Brexit isn't going to save anyone and won't save anyone, and it's probably ruined a lot of people. But that's, you know, that's gone, that's over, and we all have to deal with it in some way. But art is going to be here to stay. And art is something that is incredibly important in the lives of everyone, whether they realise it or not. It is around them. It is everything we see and touch and feel and hear and everything. And it is something that accompanies our whole lives, and it's something that is in our lives. But is it something that can save humanity?
That's a hell of a question. Art, it can save me, and it can save many people I know. I don't know whether it can save humanity. I don't know. I think it's a secondary thing to what... Maybe Greta Thunberg can save humanity. Maybe Boris Johnson can destroy humanity, or Donald Trump, or Bolsonaro, or whoever. Or maybe we will just destroy ourselves. I mean... save humanity. I think we're on a slow, long, slow course to annihilation, to be honest, to be got rid of, because we are very bad. We are a very bad species, I think. And I think slowly things are happening that, you know, the Earth doesn't need us, the planet doesn't need us. So I don't even know if we're worth saving. Are we worth saving? Do we need to
I agree with you on to the extent that maybe we are a very bad species, but there are good specimens amongst the bad species. And I appreciate the fact that you have created so much wonderful art over your life. And I have to say, just finally, during COVID, your music was one of the things that saved me and two friends of mine, a couple who have three children, who were my bubble during COVID. And we spent many hours dancing and around the kitchen table in their flat to your music. So, Anne Clark, thank you so much.
Thanks
for the interview. And I'd love to come back to you one day and talk about your later work, because we concentrated so much on your early life.
I'd love that.
Maybe I can come back and do that at another time.
And I'd love to discover your work too, definitely.
Oh, I'd send you some. I'll send you a script.
Please.
There you go.
Fantastic. I'd love that.
All right.
Okay, Stephen. Thank you very
again.
Much. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Bye.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.